Thank you, Vanaraji. Now, if you notice this great sheaf of papers I'm lifting up and your heart sinks with a sort of, oh no, let me reassure you, I use a very large font, so there's not actually very much written on each page, but it's not all written down. So this talk is called Turning the Wheel of the Dharma. A few weeks ago we were celebrating Wesak, the Buddha's enlightenment, and now we've got Dharma Day coming up this weekend. This is a celebration of the Buddha setting the wheel of the Dharma in motion. I'm going to explore what it was that the Buddha discovered and then taught, what the Buddha's Dharma really is. So taking our minds back to the events of the Buddha's enlightenment, we learn from the Pali Suttas that the Buddha sat for 7 days under a Bodhi tree on a bank of the river Naranjara at Duruvela. And I'm going to read from one of the early Pali canon texts, the Udana, and this is from chapter 1, called Enlightenment. Then the Exalted One, after the lapse of those 7 days, during the first watch of the night, rousing himself from that concentration of mind, gave close attention to causal uprising in direct order. Thus, this being that becomes, by the arising of this, that arises. Namely, conditioned by ignorance, activities. Conditioned by activities, consciousness. Conditioned by consciousness, mind and body. Conditioned by mind and body, the 6 sense spheres. Conditioned by the 6 sense spheres, contact. Conditioned by contact, feeling. Conditioned by feeling, craving. Conditioned by craving, grasping. Conditioned by grasping, becoming. Conditioned by becoming, birth. Conditioned by birth, old age and death, grief, lamentation, suffering, sorrow and despair come into being. In the Pali scriptures we're told that the Buddha, having seen reality, thought, this Dhamma that I have attained to is profound and hard to see, hard to discover. This generation relies on attachment, relishes attachment, delights in attachment. It is hard for such a generation to see this truth. And if I taught the Dhamma, others would not understand me. And considering thus, his mind favoured inaction and not teaching the Dhamma. Then we hear that Brahma Sahampati, becoming aware of what the Buddha was thinking, appeared before him saying, Lord, let the Blessed One teach the Dhamma. Let the Sublime One teach the Dhamma. There are beings with little dust on their eyes who are wasting through not hearing the Dhamma. The Buddha listened to Brahma Sahampati and out of compassion he surveyed the world. Just as in a pond of blue, red or white lotuses, some lotuses that are born and grow in the water thrive immersed in the water without coming up out of it. And some other lotuses that are born grow in the water and rest on the water's surface. And some other lotuses that are born and grow in the water come right up out of the water and stand clear, unwetted by it. So too he saw beings with little dust on their eyes and with much dust on their eyes, with keen faculties and dull faculties, with good qualities and bad qualities, easy to teach and hard to teach. And here we have the lotuses on these lovely wall hangings. And as you know, the lotus, it's a symbol we use a great deal. So the Buddha, having seen that people vary a great deal and that there would be some people who would be ready to and able to learn, decided he would teach the Dharma. His first thought was to teach his 2 old teachers. You may remember that he'd spent many years wandering in the quest for liberation, for enlightenment, and he spent quite a long time with 2 meditation teachers and actually went quite a long way with his meditation practice. but left them because he knew that there was further to go, and that he couldn't go any further with those particular teachers. So this was his first thought, but they had actually both died. So he then thought of the group of five ascetics that he'd been wandering and practicing with before he decided to give up the really austere practices they were doing, because they weren't going to lead him to liberation. And he left them to go off on his own. So he set off in search of his previous companions. We have the story of how on the way the Buddha met a wandering holy man called Upaka. Or Upaka. Don't know. This was the first person who saw the Buddha after his enlightenment. Upaka could see there was something rather special about the Buddha and asked him in the traditional manner who his teacher was. The Buddha tells him that he has no teacher, that he's discovered the truth for himself. I go to Kasi's city now to set the wheel of Dhamma in motion. And then it says, when this was said, the monk Upaka, or Upaka, remarked, may it be so, friend. Shaking his head, he took a side road and departed. So the Buddha immediately comes across someone who isn't ready to hear the Dharma. Well, what about us? How would we respond if we met the Buddha? The story goes on that the five ascetics saw the Buddha coming, and they agreed among themselves that they weren't going to have too much to do with him. They thought, well, he could sit down if he wanted to, but they weren't otherwise going to treat him with any of the customary ways of hospitality. As far as they were concerned, he was the monk who became self-indulgent, who gave up the struggle and reverted to luxury. And you may remember, he took a little bit of boiled rice and some dry bread or something. So this was the reverting to luxury. But as the Buddha approached them, they found themselves unable to stick to this because they were drawn to him. It then took a little bit of convincing on the Buddha's part that he hadn't reverted to a life of luxury and was in fact now fully enlightened. But after the customary Pali Canon three times of asking, they settled down to listen to what he had to say. Bhikkhus, there are these two extremes that ought not to be cultivated by one who has gone forth. What two? There is devotion to pursuit of pleasure in sensual desires, which is low, coarse, vulgar, ignoble and harmful. And there is devotion to self-mortification, which is painful, ignoble, and harmful. The middle way discovered by the perfect one avoids both these extremes. It gives vision, gives knowledge, and leads to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nirvana. So straight away the Buddha talks about the middle way that lies between these two extremes. And what is that middle way? It is the Noble Eightfold Path. That is to say, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. The Buddha then goes on to teach the Four Noble Truths. There is this noble truth of suffering. Birth is suffering. Aging is suffering. Sickness is suffering, death is suffering, sorrow and lamentation, pain, grief and despair are suffering. Association with the loathed is suffering. Dissociation from the loved is suffering. Not to get what one wants is suffering. There is the noble truth of the origin of suffering. It is craving. Craving for sensual desires. Craving for being, craving for non-being. There is the noble truth of the cessation of suffering. It is the giving up, relinquishing, letting go and rejecting of that same craving. There is the noble truth of the way leading to the cessation of suffering. It is this Noble Eightfold Path, That is to say, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. Now, we're probably all familiar to some extent with these two formulations, the Four Noble Truths and the Noble Eightfold Path. We say them every time we chant the Heart Sutra. There is no pain or cease of pain, nor is there pain or cause of pain, or cease of pain, or noble path to lead from pain. We may get the idea that the teaching is basically a teaching about suffering, but that's not the case. The Buddha picked on suffering to illustrate what he was teaching because suffering is so universally experienced. Everyone knows what it's like to suffer in some way or other. As the Buddha says, it's not just pain and illness. It's being where you don't want to be or with who you don't want to be with. It's not being where you do want to be or with who you do want to be with. It's not getting what you want or finding yourself with what you don't want. And we've all experienced suffering in these ways. And this is the reason the Buddha uses suffering to explain the Four Noble Truths. But what the Buddha is really explaining is the fundamental truth of conditionality. And we could actually replace suffering with anything else in the formula. In the first extract I read from the Udana of the story of the Buddha's enlightenment, we heard, "Then the Exalted One, after the lapse of those 7 days, during the first watch of the night, rousing himself from that concentration of mind, gave close attention to causal uprising. Thus, this being that becomes. By the arising of this, that arises." And then it carries on through the causal processes we know as the 12 Nidanas, which we're familiar with as the outer circle of the Tibetan Wheel of Life. Returning to the teaching of the Four Noble Truths, which the Buddha has just delivered to the 5 ascetics, we are told that one of them, Kadanya, gains immediate understanding and says, "All that is subject to arising is subject to cessation. And when the wheel of the Dhamma had been set rolling by the Blessed One, the earth deities cried out, 'At Benares, in the deer park at Isipatana, the Perfect One, accomplished and fully enlightened, has set rolling the matchless wheel of the Dhamma.'" In another part of the Pali scriptures, we have the story of how the Buddha's 2 main disciples, Sariputta and Moggallana. Now, you may be familiar with them as Sariputra and Moggallana. As you know, there are these 2 languages which are thought to have been around at the time of the Buddha, Pali and Sanskrit. And they're very similar, but most words are slightly different in each languages. And in our tradition, Trivatna, we use words from both languages, and we tend to have a bit of a mishmash, really. So when I was reading from the Pali canon, I was saying Dhamma, which we probably know more familiar with as Dharma. And if you were listening very carefully, you might have noticed Nibbana, which we are more familiar with as the Sanskrit Nirvana. So Sariputta and Moggallana, how they come to first hear the Buddha's teaching. So they were good friends and both disciples of a wandering teacher called Sanjaya. And they'd made a pact with each other that as soon as one of them attained enlightenment, he would find the other one and inform him. So one day when Sariputta was out, he saw one of the Buddha's disciples called Asaji, who was out on his alms round. Sariputta was very struck by the manner of this man and believed he must be an arahant. So when Asaji had finished his alms round, Sariputta went up to him and asked him who his teacher was and what he taught. Asaji tells him that his teacher is the Buddha, but that he himself is very new to the Dharma and therefore can't explain it in detail. But he can tell him it in brief. He says, "Ismas mim sati, idam oti, imas upada, idam upajati. Imas mim asati, idam na uti. Imasa niroda, idam nirujati." Translated, this being that becomes. From the arising of this, that arises. This not being, that does not become. From the ceasing of this, that ceases. And the story is, on hearing this verse, Sariputta becomes immediately enlightened. He goes off to find his friend, Moggallana, repeats the verse, whereupon Moggallana also gains enlightenment. So how many of you have become enlightened on the spot at hearing this verse? This verse gives us the law of conditionality, called Pratityasamutpada in Sanskrit. And it really is the basic, most central teaching of Buddhism. So what does it mean? What is the meaning of conditionality? It's sometimes called conditioned co-production, and although that's rather a clumsy phrase, I prefer it because I think it a little bit more accurately describes what it is. Conditionality is not simple cause and effect. It is not a linear A causes B. It's much more complex than that. We need to see the whole multitude of conditions which come together and give rise to something, and which then itself becomes a condition for the arising of something else. So in this present moment, I'm standing here talking, and you are sitting there listening. I'm here on the basis of being a person who came into being on the basis of my parents getting together. I've survived long enough to be here now on the basis of all the conditions which have brought me good health. Food, clean water to drink, good medical care. I'm able to give a talk on the basis of the conditions which enabled me to become reasonably well educated. My brain cells, my parents' motivation, being born in a country with free schooling and even free universities when I went to them. I'm able to give a talk on the Dharma on the basis of Bhante having come back from India and deciding to stay here and start a movement. Of my having come across the movement and got involved with it. I'm here in the LBC Shrine Room on the basis of a group of dedicated people putting an enormous amount of work and effort into creating this centre in the early years of our movement and the ongoing commitment of others to keep it going. I'm here this evening because the class team asked me. So why are you here? If you think about it, you'll see hundreds and thousands of conditions which have come together to put you here in this shrine room right at this moment. But are you listening? Maybe you are, maybe not. Maybe you're listening on and off. What are the conditions which determine whether or not you're listening? Perhaps you have more pressing things on your mind. Perhaps you feel sleepy or tired or just bored. What is it that catches your attention or fails to engage you? If you drifted off and I cracked a joke and everyone laughed, would you stay in your daydream or would you start listening again? And why? We can endlessly look at all the many conditions which have brought this moment into being. Then we see that this moment isn't static. We don't stay the same from moment to moment. The conditions which bring this moment into being are in fact a continuous flow of ever-changing processes. And this moment itself is part of that process. In fact, there isn't a moment at all, because there is no static point in time. The conditions giving rise to what is are in continuous flow of change, as are the conditions which brought each of those conditions into being. And as you sit here, you are yourselves just an ever-changing flow. Think about all the processes going on in your bodies. The air entering your lungs, the oxygen being picked up by the blood cells, carried through the arteries to the capillaries, the complex exchange taking place in all the cells, carbon dioxide being carried back through to the heart through the veins and exhaled. What's going on in your digestive system? Think of all the processes involved in turning your last meal and the liquids you've drunk into energy and waste products. Imagine all the work taking place in your kidneys, in your liver. And what about your external skin? It is continuously sloughing off dead cells. Billions of dead cells, dead skin cells, float from our bodies every day. The shrine room is becoming littered with dead skin cells. We don't see them because the floor is also covered with tiny mites feeding on those dead skin cells. And what about your mind? Is that standing still? There is an endless process of thoughts and emotions going through your mind. So this is the meaning of that rather simple-seeming verse, this being, that becomes. From the arising of this, that arises. This not being, that does not become. From the ceasing of this, that ceases. Things continually come into being on the basis of conditions and cease to be in that form as the conditions change. Whatever has come into being itself conditions what comes next. We see a lot of continuity because the conditions which come together to give rise to something are themselves all changing at different rates, dependent on the conditions which have given rise to them. We know that every cell in our body changes at least once every 7 years. And we don't, in this moment, have a single cell in our body which we had when we were 7 years younger. If we look at old photographs, we can see how much we've changed. But we don't notice the changes day by day. We recognise our friends if we see them regularly and may think they look much the same week to week. But if we don't see someone for several years, we may not recognise them at all. Last year I was put back in touch with an old friend of mine who emigrated to Canada about 45 years ago, and I haven't seen her since. And we have a nephew in common. So my brother's son is her sister's son, and he put us back in touch with each other. We've been out of touch for all those years. And we started an email correspondence. So I have a very clear picture of Jenny, as she was in her 20s. And then I get these emails all about her grandchildren. And there was an incongruity between this person I was imagining and this grandmotherly role that she was telling me about. So I asked her to send me a photograph. And she sent one which had just been taken of her standing with a friend. And she said, in case you don't know which one is me, I'm the one on the right wearing the white top. And when I looked at the photograph, I realised that I really would not have known which one was her. It would have taken me quite a while to work it out, because neither of them looked anything like this person I remembered. In The Three Jewels, Bhante says, conditioned things are no more than the totality of their constituent parts or functions. And when they change, there is nothing which changes apart from the process of change itself. So Pratichasamutpada, conditioned co-production, is the central teaching of Buddhism. It is the basis of the Dharma from which all the other teachings flow. If we understand conditionality, we can understand the three lakshanas, the three marks of conditioned existence. Firstly, we have impermanence. Because everything is a continual flow of coming into being and ceasing, because everything is a complex system of process, there is nothing which is permanent. I have a large London plane tree outside my kitchen window. And every morning when I'm getting my breakfast, I spend a few moments looking at it. The council pollarded it this year, and they did it very late. It was sort of like late March or even early April, so it was there as just a stump again, you know, pollard a tree. But soon buds appeared and little twigs and leaves and so on, and now it's quite leafy. So every day it's different. Every day it has grown more. It's very tempting to think that the change all happens while I'm asleep. But of course it's not like that. Change is happening all the time. There is no moment when the leaves are not changing. And if I stood still long enough and watched, I would see the change taking place. But of course that would require far too much patience. Like watching paint dry, is what we say. And it might be a very good idea, actually, a very worthwhile thing to do, to sit and watch paint dry. And we'd see that it isn't that paint is wet and then sometime later dry, that there is a continuous process of change from wet to dry. Now, we know everything is impermanent, of course we do. We see it very clearly when we think about it. Yet we so often don't truly understand impermanence at a deeper level. How often are we shocked by sudden death? How often are we unprepared for unforeseen illness or misfortune? How surprised are we when relationships or friendships we thought would last forever change and end? We know we are going to die. But do we assume death for us is a long way off and that there'll be plenty of time later on to sort everything out in preparation for it? We know that many of the conditions which give rise to things are both unknown and far beyond our control. Yet do we really believe this? If we did, why would we assume that we'll still be alive tomorrow? Everything is impermanent. There is nothing which stands still. There is no static, fixed centre to things. So we have the second lakshana of insubstantiality. There is nothing substantial, nothing fixed. There is no inherent fixed selfhood in anything. And that includes us. There is no unchanging fixed self. When we talk about ourselves as if we were something recognisably fixed and unchanging, what we're really talking about are our habitual tendencies, our habits. We want to fix ourselves and other people because it gives us a sense of certainty, a sense of security. But it's a very false sense of security because there is no certainty and can be no certainty. How often do we find ourselves thinking, I'm the kind of person who does or likes such and such? Or, I'm not that sort of person. You've changed, people say, in a very accusing manner. She's not like herself, we say. He wasn't himself when he did that, you know. And it's all so much better now she's more like herself again. But there isn't any fixed, unchanging self. Only habits. In fact, we are a different self in every moment. And not even for a moment do we stay the same. In Living as a River, Bodhipaksha writes, although there seems to be little or nothing that's unchanging in us, there is a persistent sense of continuity. It's part of the way that Buddhist teachings view the self. A traditional image is to think of a rope. A rope is not a single thing, but a composite of innumerable smaller strands of fibre. No single strand runs the entire length of the rope. In fact, an individual strand may cover only a few inches of the rope's entire length. And so the rope has no essence. Similarly, what we call a self has no essence, but instead is formed of innumerable physical and mental events that overlap and provide continuity. The rope, or the self, does indeed have continuity, but it lacks identity. That is, one end of the rope is composed of entirely different stuff from the other end of the rope. This, then, is the underlying principle of selfhood in Buddhism, that there's continuity but no identity. If everything is a continuous process of change and there is no certainty, there is no security, and that brings us to the third lakshana, which is unsatisfactoriness. We cannot control all the conditions in our lives. We don't get what we want, and we get what we don't want. We suffer continuously because life doesn't go the way we want it to. We experience conditioned existence as unsatisfactory. We are conditioned beings. What we are at any moment comes into being on the basis of numerous conditions. Our physical bodies, our feelings, emotions, our thoughts, our environment, the people we are in contact with, their feelings towards us, their kindness, friendliness, hostility, anger, demands, expectations. We do not exist in isolation. We are affected by the people around us, and similarly, we affect them in the way we act, speak, and think. And it's not just the people around us who condition the way we are. We are dependent for life on the food we eat, and hundreds of people we don't even know have played a part in bringing that food to us. We've been conditioned by our parents' genes, by our upbringing, our education. We've come to this point in dependence on many, many people who have nurtured, taught, socialised and influenced us. In fact, we are totally interconnected with the rest of humanity. We condition and are conditioned by other people, who in turn condition and are conditioned by yet more. Harsh, unkind words have a negative effect on both myself and the person I speak to. The negative effect on myself affects my mood and makes it more difficult for me to feel positive and loving. My mind feels contracted and heavy, not expansive and light. The effect of my words on the other person makes her feel upset. She finds it harder to remain open and friendly, and this affects the way she interacts with the next person she meets. When I was a child, we had a saying, "Sticks and stones can break my bones, but words can never hurt me." It's complete rubbish. A much more reliable source is the Dhammapada, which says, "Speak quietly to everyone, and they too will be gentle in their speech. Harsh words hurt, and come back to the speaker." The effect of words is tremendous. We can't afford to speak unmindfully. And it's not just what we say, what we are thinking conditions ourselves and others in much the same way. We cannot sit silently, full of hostility towards someone, believing that they have no sense of it. The way we communicate is of the utmost importance if we really want to lead a spiritual life. It does seem in this modern age that, you know, everybody is communicating all the time because everybody is endlessly talking on mobile phones or doing Twitter and Facebook and all this stuff. But it's not real communication. If you sit on a bus, you're obliged to hear somebody's phone conversation. And have you noticed how people, well, they hardly stop to draw breath, let alone to let the other person say anything. So you sort of think, well, is the other person on the other end, just sitting silently saying nothing? I rather suspect not, and that the other person is also talking, and neither of them are listening to each other. How often do we dash off emails without any sense of the effect of our words on the person who's receiving? It makes me think, it reminds me of when I was working in evolution and we sold a card, which I thought was very funny. The picture was of a dog sitting at a computer keyboard and the caption was, "The great thing about the internet is that nobody ever needs to know you're a dog." So coming back to the Dharma. The word Dharma actually has a lot of meanings, but with a capital D, which is the way we're using it, it has a sort of two-part meaning. It means truth, reality. That is the objective content of the Buddha's enlightenment experience. And it also means teaching, which is the Buddha's expression of that experience for the benefit of others. So truth and reality and the teaching of it. In Who is the Buddha? Bhante says, "Full illumination arose within him, and he became enlightened." Some of the early texts try to give us some idea of the content of that experience, but this is by no means an easy thing to attempt. Enlightenment is inherently ineffable. Now, ineffable is one of those words that Bhante uses a great deal, and probably most people don't have in their daily vocabulary. It means inexpressible, something that can't be put into words. So enlightenment is inherently ineffable. It is not to be circumscribed by the rational mind. However, to begin with, we can say that it is a state of pure, clear, radiant awareness. And it is sometimes specified that in this state of awareness, one no longer makes any emotional distinction between oneself and others. That sense we have of an inner world set against the world outside ourselves is entirely transcended. There is just one continuous, pure and homogeneous awareness extending freely in all directions. It is, moreover, an awareness of things as they really are. This means an awareness of things not as objects, but as transcending the duality of subject and object. Hence, this pure, clear awareness is also spoken of as an awareness of reality. Reality is that we are part of conditioned existence, samsara. We are conditioned beings, impermanent, with no fixed, unchanging self. And our lives, being transitory, are unsatisfactory. We do not exist in isolation, but are interconnected with all other beings. We are in a constant process of change. And if we want to change in the direction of becoming kinder, more loving, more generous, having a more positive effect in the world, we need to align ourselves more with reality. We need to become more aware of what we are doing and what is going on around us. How often do we drift off into a world of fantasy, get caught up in and seduced by a make-believe world where everything seems so much cozier than real life? And now I will tell a joke. One day a woman was out walking and she met a frog. And the frog said, "Give me a kiss." And the woman said nothing. The frog said, "Go on, give me a kiss." And the woman still said nothing. And the frog said, "What's the matter with you? Don't you want me to turn into a handsome prince?" And the woman said, "Well, actually, at this point in my life, I'm much more interested in a talking frog." So 2,500 years ago, the Buddha set the wheel of the Dharma in motion. The wheel of the Dharma is symbolized by the Dharma chakra, a wheel with eight spokes. chakra was the name given to the Right Livelihood business set up in our movement in the early days to record and distribute the tapes of Bhante's lectures, and which has evolved over the years and become Free Buddhist Audio, which is accessed by thousands of people all over the world, and which I'm sure many of you use yourselves. The Buddha, having set the wheel of the Dharma in motion, it has been kept rolling down the years by all the Buddhist teachers and practitioners. And we keep it rolling today by continuing to practice and teach the Dharma, by continuing to try and bring ourselves more and more into a deeper understanding of reality through our practice of ethics and meditation. Every one of us who has faith in the Buddha and in the Dharma, who seriously wants to make progress on the spiritual path towards enlightenment, plays our own part in keeping the wheel of the Dharma rolling. We spread the Dharma by exemplification. The way we behave has an effect on others. We spread the Dharma through honest, kind interaction with others. Everyone can participate in some way in the running of our centre, which enables so many people to learn about and practice the Dharma, whether by practical help, financial help, or simply by being friendly to newcomers. We can all help to spread the Dharma. I mentioned Free Buddhist Audio, which is a wonderful resource of talks, lectures, seminars, and study material. The site really does get used by thousands of people throughout the world who would otherwise have no access to the Dharma. And many of these people would be unable to pay for the material, so it's essential that the site remains free. But it does cost money to run and cannot continue unless financially supported by people who can afford to contribute. Please bear this in mind when you download your Mitra study material and help to keep spreading the Dharma worldwide by helping to keep this wonderful website running. The Buddha set the wheel of the Dharma in motion 2,500 years ago. Let's do our part to keep it rolling.